Pre-Socratics, Part 1, the second talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas, was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 10, 2012, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number one in this series.
We started with ancient polytheism. We talked about that last week. There was a question that got asked that I want to address before we move on to the pre-Socratics. The question was, would I comment on the two commandments in the Ten Commandments in the light of polytheism, the one about having no other god before you, and then the prohibition against graven images. What's going on there? How would I understand that? The first one, that you shall have no other god before you, that, of course, could make sense even in the context of polytheism. I mean, even if God was only the top of the heap on the pantheon of gods, he would still be asking for soul allegiance, that you worship no other god and you only worship him. However, in the context of the dialogue that I believe I mentioned between Moses and God on Mount Sinai, where he says, your fathers knew me as El Shaddai, but from now on you will know me as Yahweh. Did I talk about that here? I didn't talk about that. All right. I don't know if it was the initial conversation, but in one of the conversations that Moses has with the burning bush, Yahweh the burning bush, up on Mount Sinai, Moses asks him, who shall I say sent me? And he declares his name to be Yahweh. And somewhere in that context, he said, your fathers knew me as El Shaddai, but from now on, you will know me as Yahweh. Well, that was a very seminal moment, I think, in the progress of revelation throughout the God's dealings with the Jews, because scholars are not really clear what El Shaddai is supposed to mean, but the majority opinion seems to be it's some kind of synonym for the God Most High, that it's the God at the top of the heap kind of idea. And so God is basically saying there, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they more or less were thinking like polytheists, and they just simply thought of me as the Most High God, the most important God in the pantheon. So that's how your fathers used to think of me. But from now on, you will know me as Yahweh. Well, Yahweh, probably you have heard in Christian culture that translated as I am, that God's name is I am. That's always been rather confusing to me. I'm not sure that's actually right. Maybe that's right. But in any case, the ancient Greek translation of the Hebrew text translates it Ha-On, the one who is, or he who is. And I think that captures better in something like our idiom what the name is trying to say. God is the one who is in a way that we isn't. You know, when we isn't, he still is. The way I've tended to describe it is that if you were to invent a magic ontological eraser that exists, that erases things that are, erases things that exist, and if you took that eraser and erased everything that exists, God would still be there. All of his creation would disappear, but God would still be there, because God does not be, he super bees, he more than bees, he bees to the max. And so when we recognize that, yes, he exists, but he exists with a different kind of existence, on another plane of existence, another order of existence, an existence that's not vulnerable to going out of existence the way we are. I know I talked about that, God's necessary existence versus our contingent existence. Well, I think the name Yahweh is intended to capture that conception of God and who God is. The first commandment then is in the context of that seminal moment where God has redefined who he is to Moses. Not that the people got it. I'm not claiming that from then on Israel thought of him that way, because they didn't. We know they didn't, looking at their history. They were constantly treating him as just one more of many of the polytheistic type gods. And they're constantly being rebuked for that, basically. So in the context of that redefinition of who God is, I think the right way to understand you shall have no other God before you is, I don't want you to be thinking of me as just another option for worship, not because I want your soul allegiance merely, although that's true, but because there is no other rival to me. There is no other God that counts. So I and I alone should be the preoccupation of your religious devotion and your service. Then the second commandment, to not have any graven images, I think that can only be understood in the context of polytheism, I think. Because the graven images in polytheism, the little household gods and the various, you know, statuettes and emblems and amulets and things that they would create and craft, that wasn't just art. That wasn't just symbolic. Those weren't just symbolic representations of God. Those were actually implements that they believed focused the power and authority and activity of that God. And I think what God is saying is, if you understand who I am, it makes absolutely no sense for you to go pretending like there's any place where my power and authority can be focused, because there's not a centimeter of this created order that I don't have direct and immediate access to with my full power and authority. It all belongs to me. There is no inch of it that doesn't belong to me. So don't limit me. Don't think of me as limited in what I can do and where I can do it. I don't have to act in the temple. I can act anywhere, anytime, anyhow. So it's basically commanding them to have a kind of a robust, full-bodied concept of who God is and the implications of that. He's the transcendent author of all reality who can do anything, anywhere, anytime. So that's how I would interpret those two commandments. And I do think when we try to remove them from their context and put them into our context, we come up with some pretty bizarre conclusions. So, for example, there are Christian traditions who argue that you can't have any Christian art, really. You shouldn't do anything in art to try to portray God, because the second commandment says don't have a graven image. Well, I think that misconstrues that second commandment. It doesn't even understand what God was asking of. Okay, any questions on that?
Talking about Christian traditions that say that you shouldn't have icons and images of God. So are you talking about like the Puritans?
Yeah, for example. The,
okay. Yeah. So like...
Now, go ahead. I mean, if I were there at the time, the Puritans, maybe I'd be on their side. I mean, it may be that their objection is for different reasons. But what I'm contending is, if your only reason is the second commandment, or whichever one it is, that's not good enough. Because that's not what God is talking about in relation to Israel.
So, like, in the context of Greek Orthodox or Catholic iconography, where you have, like, you know, some picture of Jesus and, like, a dove above him and him being baptized or something like that, you think that's, like, all right, you know, no big deal?
Yeah, I think that's basically all right. Now, I'm going to show my ignorance here, but I believe in Orthodoxy. They look at their icons as a window into heaven. Mm-hmm. That's beginning to sound like polytheism. Now, I don't pretend to know enough to know. Maybe there's some significant differences that make it come short of that. But to a novice like me, to someone who's ignorant like me, it sure sounds like what you're saying is the presence of God is particularly at work there through your meditation in the icon, as opposed to anywhere else. Well, I think that is a violation of the Second Commandment.
Okay,
if that's the way we're conceiving of it.
Like in traditional iconography, if I have like a picture of Moses, like Saint Moses, then or if I focus on that picture and I might like kiss the picture, they kiss the icon sometimes, and they believe that it's kind of like kissing Moses. Like if I had a picture of my mom who was, if she was dead, you know, and I kissed the picture of my mom, you know, the idea is that, well, she's not separated from me. She somehow receives my adoration and my love in heaven. And so in iconography, it's like a way of connecting with the saints or Jesus or something like that. So you're not condemning the art, but you're saying that kind of mystical connection to it's probably wrong.
Yeah, that it may very well run afoul of the commandment in to not have graven images, because it's based on a similar conception of God being limited in a particular way.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's possible.
I hope I don't sound like a devil's advocate on this, but what do you think the rule of the I think it's the Ark of the Covenant, and would that be a graven image, and why or why not?
No, I don't think so, because I think what makes a graven image is it's supposed to be an image representing God Himself, and that's what's significant. When I took my first trip to Israel, it was with an Old Testament professor, archaeologist. And he took us to downtown Tel Aviv, and we were overlooking this archaeological dig, and he said, this is a Philistine temple. There's the Holy of Holies, there's the holy place, and there's the outer court. Which at the time, I didn't know much, and that really sent me really my first response. A Philistine temple is just like the temple that God prescribed in Jerusalem. And then he went on to propose, and this has made all the sense in the world to me. What he went on to propose is, you know, there's really two ways you could think about that. But one way of looking at it, and that's the way most, you know, kind of secular biblical scholars look at it, is the Hebrews told a story of God coming and revealing their religion to them, and it was specifically given them by God, and they practiced the religion that God gave them. And it was divinely unique, this religion that he was giving them. That's the story they told. But in actuality, what happened is they went over to Babylon and looked down there at Egypt, and they saw what they were doing down there. They ripped it off, came back, borrowed it, came back and did that in Jerusalem, and then rewrote history to make it sound like God gave it to them. We all are sophisticated enough to know, yeah, right, God gave it to you, right? That's one interpretation. The other interpretation, and this is what makes sense to me and to him, is the whole ancient world was deeply, deeply religious. Every culture was a religious culture. Their government was based on religion. Their way of life was based on religion. Every aspect of their society was centered in religion. One thing they knew and understood was religion. Offerings, sacrifices, temples, holy places, all of that. So if God wants to come and reveal himself to a people who are immersed in a religious world, what better way to reveal yourself to them than in a religious language? You guys want to be religious? Okay, let's be religious, but let's be religious this way. You want to worship me as your God? Okay, worship me as your God, but let's do it this way. And he pointed out, in some very, very important ways, God changed. He tweaked the religion in a way that is highly significant. So, in the Holy of Holies of that temple, in that Philistine temple, what would you have found if you went into the Holy of Holies? This big, huge gold statue of Dog. Not D-O-G, D-A-G, Dog, the god of the fish god of the Philistines. Remember the story where they took the Ark of the Covenant into their temple and they woke up every morning and the statue was face down toward that statue was what was sitting in the Holy of Holies of the Philistine temple, and God was saying something by having him do obeisance to the Ark of the Covenant. But what's striking is God did not ask them, did not require it of them, and in fact would have forbidden them to make a statue of him, Yahweh, and put it in the Holy of Holies. That God, by making that change in what he requires of them, he's saying something by that. You can't capture me with an image of it in a statue. I can't be captured by any one image. All of the created order reflects me. I am imaged by everything I have done, everything I have created, and everything that is. So don't single out one single thing and say, this pictures God, or this is the image of God. That's not the way it works. So, I don't remember your question. Did I answer your question?
About the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, okay. So what's in the Holy of Holies instead is the Ark of the Covenant, which is not a graven image of God. They are various implements that remind Israel of the history of their dealings with God and reflect various aspects of who God is as that got played out in their history. So that's what he does instead.
Okay, so continuing on, I'm thinking about this. Didn't the Jews see the Ark of the Covenant and the temple and certain things as being places where God's power presence was concentrated in some sense? That's why you have that story of dog, you know, bowing to the Ark of the Covenant, because there's some kind of thing going on there in the conception of the Jews.
Yeah, the question is, though, is it exclusively there? Maybe in some, with some, maybe it's there with some special significance. So, like, in the time that they are camping out in the wilderness, God comes along and lives in a tent with them, beside them, and you know he's home when the cloud descends and sits over the meeting, the tent of meeting. So he symbolizes, you know, he puts his open for business sign out so that Moses knows that he can come and consult with him. So, yeah, there are senses in which he portrays himself as now present. But that's different from having a concept of God where that's all he can do, mm-hmm. where God can only be present in special places or particular places.
So the issue between paganism and Judaism is not God being manifestly present in one place versus another place, but the issue is really God's universal providence, whether or not he is universally
that's
there.
Right. I think so. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anything else on polytheism? We want to shift gears here to the pre-Socratics. Okay, you have on one of the pages that you have in the handouts, you have the most important pre-Socratic philosophers. So we'll briefly kind of discuss them and who they are. The earliest school of pre-Socratic philosophers is what they typically called the Milesian school. The Milesian school is a school that's centered in Miletus. Miletus is on the coast of what today would be southwestern Turkey. Well, we have a question. Okay.
So Logan from the online stuff wants to know if the book of Daniel reveals how God was there for them in a foreign land.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, definitely. Because typically in polytheism, there were bound... Kind of like grizzly bears or something. There's kind of boundaries on a god's territory. You know, he stakes out his territory and he works within that territory and not outside that territory. And a typical polytheist would think of God as not having the power to do something beyond his home territory. So that is significant. The fact that they are in captivity in Babylon and God reveals his power there, that's saying something unique about this God. He's not only bound to his own home territory, to the land of his people. He can go and work anywhere. So that's significant. Miletus was a city-state right on the southwest coast of modern-day Turkey. There's that coast of Turkey there and a bunch of islands out in the Aegean Sea surrounding there. That area is known as Ionia. And for reasons that are lost to history, we have no idea why. But all of a sudden, the whole world universally were polytheists. But all of a sudden, you have this incredible burgeoning of civilization and culture in Ionia. Particularly, philosophical thought begins to burgeon in Ionia. Many people in teaching the history of philosophies would start with them and say, this is where philosophy began. There was no philosophizing before the Ionians. But along come the Ionians, and they begin to philosophize. That happens in Melita. And the three oldest pre-Socratic philosophers then are Thales is the oldest, Anaximander next, and Anaximenes, and they are basically one generation following the other. And these are the three big prominent pre-Socratic philosophers out of Miletus, all of them out of Miletus. Thales begins to think in terms of where did the world come from? What gave rise to the world? What makes the world go, tick? What drives it? And he decided that everything is made of water. Now, on the one hand, that's a rather, from our perspective in the 21st century, it's a rather kind of infantile discovery on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, we've had thousands of years to think about it since him. On the other hand, look how, especially when it comes to living things, look how much you see that living things require fluids. And that's what he means by water. Fluids are everywhere and in everything and can be extracted from everything. And so that leads him to the conclusion, the hypothesis, I think everything, ultimately, when it comes right down to it, everything is made out of water. Now, with all the pre-Socratics, we have to think about, now, what does he mean by that? We know what we would mean by that in the 21st century. We have bought into a picture of reality that is completely and totally and wholly mechanistic, that all of reality is made of little molecules and things that don't have a brain, they don't think, they don't have any purposes, they're not going anywhere or doing anything, they're just sort of vibrating, you know, and doing whatever little subatomic things do. They just buzz. So they're just buzzing along, minding their own business and not even thinking about it. But they're buzzing along according to certain laws, structures, rules that are at play in reality. So as they buzz along, they follow those rules, and lo and behold, hocus pocus, out comes human beings and life and reality and the universe and everything else. So they are thinking in terms of, we would think in terms of water being a completely impersonal, mechanically law-driven entity. I don't think that's the way to think of the pre-Socratics. The shift is not from ancient polytheism to modern materialism. The shift is from ancient polytheism to where the gods are understood to be people-like, to be personal, to belief that there are gods, but those gods are impersonal. Impersonal, but they're still gods. They're not just little inert machines. They're gods. So water for Thales, I think, is best understood to be, I think that the god that shapes reality is water. Now notice, it may, at first blush, it may seem like that's a big departure from the ancient, the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians, but it's not that big a step, because the Egyptians thought that Re was the sun. That they had this conception that this god who was other than reality at the same time had various ways in which he entered into our reality and had his tokens and his emblems that were a part of our reality at the same time. Well, Thales is, one way of looking at it is Thales is just saying, well, the God Most High is not the sun. The God Most High is water. Water is the Most High God. But he has made a subtle but significant shift, and that is he's not thinking of the gods in two ways. The gods are not persons, people that are unpredictable and fickle and kind of mercurial. They're not like people. They're like things in the world that operate according to laws and rules. They are law-like beings. Because water, at a constant temperature, you get at the right temperature, it's always going to turn to a solid. Or you get at the right temperature, it's going to turn into a gas. It's not just when it wants to and when it's happy with you and not angry with you that it does that. It will, like clockwork, do that. It's driven by laws. So that's a significant shift. The other significant shift is he's brought the gods even closer into nature. They are not upstairs and we are downstairs. Remember in the polytheism, there's an upper story where the gods interact, and then there's the lower story that is a reflection of the actions and activities of the gods in the upper story. But there really is a sense in which the gods are in the heavens and they are transcendent. Thales, I think, is saying, there's a god, all right, but he's not in the heavens. He's in the world. He's down here with us, among us. So we've moved from, I think we can characterize it this way, not a polytheism, but a pantheism or a panentheism. He's brought the god into reality such that it is inside our reality, underlying our reality, the foundation of our reality, and immersed in our reality. Everything is made of this god. Everything is constituted of this god. So it's very much like what later will be panentheism in the 1800s.
Do we know if Thales said anything about Zeus or Athena? Did he talk about them at all?
Let's see. Many of the pre-Socratics do. Whether Thales did, I think we only have a few fragments left of Thales, so it's really, really difficult to know what he did and didn't say. And I don't recall whether we have any record of him calling water Zeus, but it wouldn't surprise me. When we get to some later, they very definitely do. They not only name them what element they think they are, but the names of two gods are attached to each element as well.
So in those later gods, will they kind of straddle the line between panentheism and some sort of polytheism?
So I don't think so. I would put them in the same category as Thales. I think that they are simply saying what we traditionally have called a god by this name and this name is actually air or is actually fire or
gotcha.
Is actually water.
Okay, thanks.
So I know what pantheism is, but you were mentioning like pantheism.
Panentheism.
Oh, panentheism. Could you explain the difference?
The only distinction would be panentheism is there's a god, but God inhabits this reality. But so let's take my ontological eraser again. I think a panentheist, if you erased reality, you still wouldn't have erased the god because the... because the boundaries of the god extend further than the boundaries of the reality of nature as we know it. Whereas a pantheist I think of, rightly or wrongly, as someone who says nature just is God and God is nature, such that if you erased nature with your ontological eraser, you just destroyed God. God's gone. So that's the only distinction. Otherwise, they're really basically identical perspectives, and that is that within nature, the inside of nature is the divine energy and force and being and creativity and so on. You think you're a panentheist? I'm sorry. Okay, moving on. So that's Thales. All of these now are, well, let me jump down to Anaximenes. Anaximenes simply says that everything is not made of water, it's made of air. So If you scrunch air into a really tight space, you get solid things. And if you stretch air out and rarefy it, you get the gases. And if you're somewhere in between, you get fluids and liquid. So everything comes from air. It's just a matter of how dense the air is. But the thing that's typical of the Milesian school, and you see it in both Thales and Anaximenes, is that they are arguing that ultimate reality is one thing, but that one thing can change forms. It's something of a shapeshifter. And so that one eternal reality that is the one thing that everything ultimately is, we see different forms. We see many different things in the world, even though everything is ultimately just one. But where do those many different things come from if everything is just one? Well, that one can change its attributes and its qualities and become different, take on different forms. Anaximander, in between the two, he was a little more sophisticated, perhaps. He said that everything is what he called in Greek, ta apeiron. Ta apeiron, you could translate it something like the indeterminate. That is, it wasn't anything in particular. Kind of like in biology, what is it, a T-cell? Am I right? That it has the capability of becoming all kinds of other cells in the body. The ta apeiron isn't anything in and of itself, but it's capable of becoming, taking the form of all of these other things. And I think he thought it came in steps where, let me look at some notes here. Yeah, what it happens by a sort of a process of separation. Everything is sort of densely, everything that is ultimately densely packed into ta apeiron, but it kind of flows out and separates out as it separates out of the indefinite and the indeterminate, and that's where everything comes from. But it's still one thing taking on different form over time.
Are these pre-Socratics ascribing any virtue or purpose or agenda to these forces that they're describing as the basis of reality?
No, and that's what's distinctive about the pre-Socratics. At least the polytheists had their gods personal, so they could have an agenda, they could have an intent, they could have a motive, they could have a purpose that they want to accomplish. It would appear, from everything I know about them, it would appear that they have turned their gods into impersonal gods and not personal gods. The place where you see that again, once again, is going to emerge in the 1800s. There are people called vitalists. Vitalists are those who believe that there's a life force that is surging through everything, and it's this life force that moves history and moves biology and moves all of reality. But the life force is not a person for them. Yeah. It's made famous by that line in Jurassic Park, life will find a way.
Yeah.
The Jeff Goldblum character, life will find a way. That's vitalism.
I was connecting that back with the Ark of the Covenant and what was in that Ark. And what was in the Ark was not only their history, but the morality mm-hmm. that the God who exists was defining for his people.
Exactly. And I think along those lines, a human being who obeys the commandments is in the image of God. If you want the likeness of God, live like this, and that will portray his likeness. How are you relating that to the pre-Socratics? Exactly. Right. Their God is not that kind of God. Their God is not a God who has an agenda, who has purposes, and so on. It's not true that they didn't worship the gods, though. And see, that's what makes me think it's easy for us in the 21st century to read, oh, Thales thinks everything is made of water. Now, that's getting close to what we think, you know. He's one of us. But, you know, the dude is as religious as anybody else, as far as we know. He still offers offerings to the god and gods and that kind of thing. And they construe that as just being kind of metaphorical, symbolic ways of worshiping the god who really is their water. But this god who really is their water is not a person with an agenda. It's just this sort of force that is pushing, shoving, shaping, driving, and motivating reality to move and change and be what it is, not to any goal. And in fact, several of them, as we will see, several of them believe in a recurring cycle, that it starts with, well, we'll get there, but they believe in a recurring cycle. There's no omega point that it's aiming at. It's just sits there churning, moving, changing. Okay, the Pythagoreans. You know Pythagoras by the Pythagorean theorem, if you've ever studied any geometry. According to some books, they think that Pythagoras didn't invent the Pythagorean theorem, but scholars question everything. What's the world coming to? Of course he invented them. Pythagoras was also from Miletus, so from the same seedbed of philosophical thought. No one knows why he left, but he left and went to a colony in southern Italy called Croton. The Ionians colonized various places, as did the other Greeks. They would transplant themselves whenever they, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Greek history is they lived in these little valleys between mountains, and they eventually ran out of room. There just wasn't room to grow. So when the population increased, the only way they could deal with the increase in population was to colonize. So they'd go somewhere else around the Mediterranean basin and find some arable land and plant a colony. But culturally, they were still connected. So that's apparently what happened with Pythagoras, and he went to southern Italy, Croton, and he began a little, what appears to be almost a little religious a religion, a religious cult, I don't know what to call it, a religious sect. Pythagoras was apparently strongly influenced by another man named Orpheus. Orpheus was a religious leader, a purely religious leader. It was a religion based on the myth of Dionysius. And the myth of Dionysius was that Zeus had a son named Dionysius. The Titans had killed Dionysius and eaten him. They ate Zeus's son. Zeus didn't much like that, so he came along and destroyed the Titans and turned them to ashes. Well, mankind was created out of the ashes of the Titans, the burned ashes of the Titans. Well, because mankind was created out of the burned ashes of the Titans, on the one hand, there's a part of them that's divine, derived from Dionysius, and then there's a part of them that's evil, derived from the Titans. So man is both good and evil, has an evil component and a divine component. His immortal soul is divine. His body is mortal and evil. Now, when we get to Plato, we're going to see that through the Pythagoreans, Plato had bought many of those assumptions. And that, so, I mean, to this day, even some aspects of attitudes and doctrines in evangelical Christianity go way back to the Pythagoreans. This basic concept that the spiritual is good and the physical is evil. Anything bodily and physical is already inherently tainted just by its very nature, and the only thing that's good is the spiritual. Well, that ultimately derives back from Orpheus and this very, very strong and compelling idea in Greek culture. So man is a soul imprisoned in a body. Death is release from that prison, at least if the soul has been purified. Then death will release the soul and it will finally be free from the prison of its body. But if the soul is not purified, then there will be a horrific punishment in store for the soul. Orpheus taught reincarnation, or sometimes it's called reincarnation, sometimes it's called the transmigration of souls, so that when you die, depending upon the state of your soul, it will be embodied in some other prison as part of the horrific punishment. And I don't know if there was some horrific punishment you get before you get imprisoned again, but either way, it's not a good thing to not have your soul be purified. If the soul is purified, then you'll go on to some kind of good afterlife, and I don't know exactly what form that took for Orpheus. How do you purify the soul? For Orpheus, it was very simply an ascetic lifestyle. ASCETISM, an ascetic lifestyle, a lifestyle of self-denial. You instead of self-indulgence, you denied yourself the various pleasures, especially the pleasures of the body. You know, so sex and food and that kind of thing, you tried to keep yourself living a very harsh life of self-denial. And that's how you purified your soul, and that's how you could guarantee a better afterlife for your soul. Well, Pythagoras was highly influenced by Orpheus and incorporated most of the components of the Orphic religion. He inspired secret esoteric brotherhoods, religious cults. They were persecuted throughout the 5th century. No one knows why, but they were persecuted. Eventually, they were driven out of Italy and back to Greece. But then for another century, they kind of chug along in Greece for a little while. But by the end of the 4th century, all those brotherhoods are gone. There are no more Pythagorean fellowships or cults. Pythagoras also believed in reincarnation, the transmigration of the soul. He was probably a vegetarian, and probably for that reason. You don't want to be eating things because you're eating people with, you know, souls. So, but I don't know why you can't come back as broccoli. I don't know. I'm not sure if I agree. But anyway, he's a vegetarian. But unlike Orphism, because in Orphism, purification is primarily just watching your diet and your level of self-indulgence and stuff like that. You wanted to purify your soul, but there are two ways you did it. You lived an ascetic lifestyle, yes, but you also engaged in what he calls contemplation and inquiry. So your intellectual life, by gaining knowledge, by asking questions and seeking answers, seeking wisdom and seeking understanding about the cosmos, the very act of seeking understanding of the cosmos was itself purifying to the soul. The soul is the life of the mind, particularly for Pythagoras. So by feeding the life of the mind, if you will, you are purifying your soul. And I think he makes a distinction, I think, between inquiry and what he calls contemplation. Contemplation plays a big, big role with Plato, and even beyond that in Neoplatonism. We'll look at that later. But contemplation, the best way to think of it is kind of like a rational mysticism. I mean, your mind is grasping and gaining and attaining and bringing to itself some intellectual ideas. You are seeing them. You're making intellectual contact with them, but you're not making intellectual contact with them through arguments or geometry or reasoning or deduction or those kinds of plotting, methodical kinds of ways. Contemplation is where you just see. Your mind just somehow penetrates into the secret of the otherwise invisible reality behind the universe, and you see it, you get it. That's contemplation. And that plays a huge, huge, big role in both Plato and Aristotle and the students of Plato and Aristotle all the way down into the Middle Ages. And so we have, one way or the other, as Christians, been affected by that, because in the Middle Ages, what was the ultimate thing you were trying to achieve? What they called the beatific vision, to see God. This blessed vision where you got to gaze into the face of God and see God, or alternately either see God or see all of reality in the mind of God. See all of reality the way God sees all of reality. It's a purely intellectual lust. I will be satisfied if I can know everything. And if I can know everything, then I have everything. That is the ultimate fulfillment of a human being. You know, Aristotle's eventually going to say, man is a rational animal. How is a rational animal fulfilled? By fulfilling his reason. It's knowledge and understanding and wisdom that fulfills a human being. So, I mean, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but the ideas of Pythagoras wind their way through history and are actually still, to one degree or another, still influencing us today. So the regimen of the Pythagorean were living an aesthetic lifestyle according to ascetic principles, a life of theoria, contemplation, and inquiry. Pythagoras was once asked how he would characterize himself, and he said, "I'm a philosopher." And he's apparently the one who coined the term philosophy. Don't know that he's the one who mainstreams it. I think that's Socrates, but the term originally came from Pythagoras. And what he meant by that is seeking knowledge for its own sake rather than for some practical benefit that comes from it. You know, I'm not seeking knowledge so that I can sway the assembly or so that I can invent something or, you know, some social political effect or some social political advantage that I gain by knowledge. I want to know because I want to know. And why do I want to know because I want to know? Because that purifies the soul.
So, Jack, is this high level of contemplation then, would that be called enlightenment? So if a person feels like, oh, wow, you know, the bulb came on, I feel enlightened.
It's what we would call enlightenment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I don't
think that's a term that he used, but that's what we would call enlightenment.
So this sense that came over a person where their reasoning skills or they contemplated something and the light bulb came on and they had a, oh, wow, you know, what do you call that? Just instead of just a high level of contemplation, what's the end result of all that contemplation, you know, when you get out here?
Are you asking what do I, Jack, call that rather than?
You don't call that enlightenment, or we do today, but they didn't back then?
Well, I've only had very limited experience with that. I mean, we can all relate to that. If you're, I remember when I was a physics student, just, you know, wrestling over a physics problem and just not being able to get it and not being able to get the right angle on looking at the problem so that I could see the solution. And then all of a sudden the light goes on. You actually find the right perspective to take on it where the solution to the problem becomes evident now. That's incredibly satisfying. I mean, I'm sure it happens in all kinds of different arenas where whenever you're problem solving of any kind and you find the solution to the problem, that pleasure, if you want to call it pleasure, that joy, that delight, that now you see the solution to the problem. Well, the beatific vision in the Middle Ages, I liken it to, they're conceiving it of it. All the problems that have ever existed for all of time, all of a sudden the light goes on and you see the answer to all of them at once. Wow, what a rush. I think that's the beatific vision. So am I answering your question?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, but what is that? What that is, I think one of the most helpful things that anyone has ever taught me is to see that my mind operates at two levels, at a conscious level and at a subconscious level, or at an articulate level and at a tacit level, that there's all kinds of stuff that I'm knowing, but I'm not knowing that I'm knowing it because I'm not conscious of knowing it. I'm not thinking of knowing it. I'm not be able to articulate to myself what I know. I just know it. And oftentimes what we call enlightenment is my mind, my intelligence has been working away like crazy at the tacit level, solving the problem. And it comes up with an answer and it raises its hand and Peter brings it the mic and it says, here's the answer. And so we experience it as, aha. But that's not a muse. That's not even necessarily God in some special kind of way. Any human being, their intelligence is built to be able to have those kinds of hunches or intuitions that we bring to conscious level. And it feels like, wow, I have a breakthrough here. And it is a breakthrough, but it's just ordinary rationality. It's ordinary human intelligence that has got me there. It's not some kind of breakthrough of my soul. Kathy has a...
I'm wondering, what's the difference between the philosophers, the pre-Socratic philosophers, and the biblical wisdom seekers who wrote the Proverbs?
Well, we'll come back to this a little bit when we get to Socrates, because Socrates is really going to stand out. Socrates cares very little about the cosmos and what it's made of and, you know, whether it's ice or fire or wind or... he actually tells a story in one of the dialogues about how I used to think that those were interesting ideas, but I decided that I'm just not smart enough to figure that stuff out. So what he focused on was, what does it mean to be a human being? And who should a human being be? And how should a human being live? And how do we clarify what our values are as human beings? It's what I would call existentialism. By what existentialism, as Kierkegaard meant that, is existence is human existence, and any approach to philosophy that focuses exclusively or primarily on answering the questions of human existence, clarifying why we are here, how we should live, what we should do with our existence, and so on, that's what I'm calling existentialism. The first existentialists were the Hebrew prophets. Proverbs, in a way, fits into that, kind of. It's only one aspect of it, but it's exploring what are the guidelines that what are the maxims that I could live my life by, that I could approximate righteousness, you know, that kind of thing.
But it's
very definitely focused on how should I as a human being live.
For Proverbs, it would be the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And that's a very existential claim. Yeah. That brings up a great point. We are seeing here with the pre-Socratics, there's really two different approaches to philosophy that you see woven throughout history. What I call the existentialist approach and the speculative approach. In speculative philosophy, you ask a question that no one could possibly have the answer to, and then you imagine an answer to it, and then you're dazzled by your own answer. That's speculative philosophy. When I first started studying philosophy, I was always fascinated by that because it kind of is intriguing because you begin to think that maybe you could actually find some answers to some of these unanswerable questions, and it's not until you get 20 different answers and they all sound good that that's what happened to Socrates, basically. You know, he got 20 different answers, they all sounded good, and he said, I don't think this is working. I'm not smart enough for that. I'm going to focus on something else. And that's kind of what happened to me as well when I got over my initial fascination with speculative type philosophy. I realized that that's kind of a dead end. You're not really going to get anywhere there. But the existential approach to philosophy that seeks to commit itself and devote itself to becoming as clear as it can on who I am, why I'm here, what I'm supposed to do with the fact that I'm here, and so on, that you can make real progress there, and that's a much more fruitful set of questions to explore. Here we are in the speculative philosophy big time with the pre-Socratics. And Socrates is going to be right at the tail end of that. He's going to look at that whole history of metaphysical speculation, and he's going to go, "Nah, I don't think so. I don't think you guys know as much as you think you do." And then head in an entirely different direction. But we'll talk about him later.
I'm just thinking timeline, though. I mean, we're looking at the pre-Socratics, but they actually came after Solomon. So we've got two different lines here. They've got the biblical existentialists and then the pre-Socratic.
That's right.
And two different timelines.
And it would be very interesting, intriguing to know what kind of interaction there might have been between Israel and the Greek city-states. Sometimes I think there's no way Socrates was not somehow impacted by one of the Hebrew prophets. But I don't know. I mean, the other possibility is God just decided to send a prophet to the Greeks, and because I think I mentioned last week, Socrates is famous for saying, I've got this daimon and I have to obey the daimon, this disembodied voice that guides me and tells me things and so on. So what is that? An unclean spirit, a demon, Satan, the force of evil? It sure doesn't look like it. Socrates says wonderful things. So I just have to wonder if God did not set this man apart to be a kind of prophet to the Greeks. Well, he was sainted by the early Catholic Church. They made him a saint. And I don't usually agree with Catholics, but on that one, no. Okay. Rats. Wow. We're out of time. Let me just finish up on the Pythagoreans. This contemplation, what is it that we grasp in this contemplation? The beauty of the order of the cosmos. If we seek knowledge for its own sake, what cleanses the soul is when we really grasp the beauty of the rational order of the cosmos. Pythagoras talks about the harmony of the spheres. He was very much into astronomy. I think the harmony of the spheres, doesn't it make it into classical music? And that became a very, very widely accepted cultural belief that the planets in their motions, they were the varying speeds of the planets as they moved was creating harmonics that we can't hear, but there are harmonics out there that are being created by the varying speeds of the planets. So the cosmos is making music. With our contemplation of numbers, Pythagoras thought that we could hear, if you will, the harmony of the spheres. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about them and go on, but that's all we have time for.